No, no, it's just been copy edited. And there's still lots of... Yeah. I went to U of T, didn't I? But, I don't know, I visit them and from time to time. So I thought in the second half I would broaden it out and look at empire building and decolonization and put some of this history that we've been looking at in a broader context. Here's an interesting image of a imperial capital, Amsterdam. And the wealth, of course, derived from empire building leads to fantastic proliferation of art. These hats that they're wearing, of course, the fur industry in Canada was largely devoted to creating these hats. The beaver were coveted for their hair. Take the hair off the skin. The hair has barbs. That's what you make felt out of, that these hats are made from. So we've been looking at empire in different ways. I've talked about this text a few times, but here's Donald Creighton's view of Canada as essentially a commercial empire of the St. Lawrence. He looks at Canada as largely a creation of entrepreneurs in Montreal who exploit the transportation system of the St. Lawrence River up into the Great Lakes. And, of course, the Northwest Company went up into the Saskatchewan, the Athabasca region, over to the Pacific. We've talked about the Empire of the Bay. Just different ways that we've talked about empire. We call this map. This is the initial trade zone created in 1670 by Charles II. Here's an interesting image from the days of the East India Company. And as I see this history, it's important to consider the role of the privateers, the here is Elizabeth the First giving some sort of honor to Sir Francis Drake. Sir Francis Drake was essentially a pirate, plundered the Spanish galleons, especially in the Pacific. He went around the world in 1577, 1580 in the Golden Hind. So the authorization of pirates to legally conduct their plunder, their theft. Pirates become privateers. Privateers acquire a certificate or some kind of sanction, and Elizabeth was famous for this, giving her favorite pirates authorization to continue what they're doing, but now with some kind of legal sanction from the sovereign. And the qualification is that you give a percentage of your take to the monarch. So this was the way the British monarchy built itself up, the English monarchy built itself up. And as I see it, then it doesn't take a big stretch to go from this to authorizing the same kind of plunder on land. So the East India Company becomes the means whereby Britain or England and then Great Britain infuse and inject their influence into India. The Dutch do it with the East Indies with their own East Indies Company, and so this is part of the system of empire building. But when you think about empire building, there's many ways we can think about it. I've been talking over the course of this class, frequently refer to Marsha McLuhan. Actually, I remember sitting in this chair. I tried to get Marsha McLuhan as a supervisor of my minor field when I was working on my PhD, and in fact, he agreed to do it, and then members of the history department didn't like him. They thought he was a fraud. They thought he was some kind of charlatan. They thought he'd violated the rules of the academy. So it was quite interesting that here's one of the most famous academics Canada's ever produced, and yet, you know, there was this hostility towards him at home. But, yeah. A charlatan? Somebody who takes advantage of situations for private gain and compromises truth, honesty, and integrity for opportunism. How, anybody got a better definition? I think that's a charlatan. That's how I'd describe it. Con man, yeah. Advertising and public opinion manipulation, I think is an aspect of empire building. I found this in a secondhand book sale, and I think this is kind of extraordinary. It goes back to 1951. And so here is McLuhan looking at advertising and calling it the folklore of industrial man. And this type of study, there's now a field called popular culture, for instance, is fairly common now, but in 1951 this was pretty cutting edge. This was pretty leaving the beaten track and looking at things that you know, most snobby professors wouldn't think would merit your time or consideration, right? Looking at junk publications, even the junk of junk publications, the advertisements in publications. So here he's looking at a cover of the New York Times, for instance, and he says, henceforth, this planet is a single city. So there's your global village. Eh? He didn't quite get that far yet in 1951, but you can see the seed of the concept is there. Okay. Understanding America. So he looks at advertisements. Here's an advertisement about oil companies, and says thousands of oil companies mean competition. Competition means progress. Progress means better living for everyone. So obviously the oil companies in this advertisement are seeking to counter the view that they're a big monolithic monopoly. And certainly that was the case in the days of Standard Oil, Rockefeller. They're trying to demonstrate that they've left that legacy. Yeah, Doran. I don't see a date, but the overall publication is 1951. So take one person who has everything to himself, and you have a monopoly. Take thousands of firms, so they're trying to show that the oil business is in fact composed of many thousands of firms. Superstation opening soon. Strive to outdo rivals, and you have the oil business. Yeah. You want to elaborate, or?
Well, I just mean like.
Yeah.
Well, just that the cartoons above it had, one big oil, or one like big New York tycoon, right?
It's an Arab guy with his harem.
Yeah. So I mean, they're
Do you want to go back? We'll just show that image. I guess that would be the image there. It's interesting, eh? They're obviously not Arab women. So that adds another element to it. So McLuhan, he asks in this text, in fact, the picture story really says, understand our kind of rivalry, and you understand why your car is somebody and you are a nobody. So that would be the classic kind of thing that I would recall him saying. You know, a lot of it was jokes and puns. and here he says, what Kipling was to the aggressive British imperialist, these ads are to our domestic economy. They act as a sort of firing spark in the internal combustion engine. So Kipling is generally seen as the poet of the British Empire, the romanticist of British imperialism. He wrote in 1899 the poem The White Man's Burden, asking that the United States go and invade the Philippines, take over the Philippines to elevate those colored people to a higher level of civilization. That was the basis of the White Man's Burden. But it's interesting that he puts advertising in this context. He says down further, yet much of the industrial world's traditional folklore consists of the arts and songs and dance and agriculture of nomadic peoples. but an industrial world cannot produce the same folk forms as can a society in a state of harmonious equilibrium with the soil and the seasons. Yet much of the industrial world's entertainment and public expression is just as unconsciously expressive of its own inner life. Our hit parade tunes, our jazz, are quite as representative of our inner lives as any old ballad is of the past way of life. And it's interesting when you think of jazz and the hit parade, when you think of the songs that were about to come into prominence. Elvis, I guess, in 1951 hadn't quite had his day. But Elvis is well known for bringing the African music, the blues, the black music of the United States, and giving it a level of recognition because he's white. He's a crossover figure. So much of American music is rooted in African music, and it's a classic expression of globalization, of the marriage and hybrid nature of these meeting of identities and cultures. Here he riffs on Freedom American Style. It's a ad for Quaker State Motor Oil. And basically, he asks, looking at the standardized equipment of this family and their standardized pattern of living, discuss how far they can be said to be free as human beings. Consider whether a uniform educational system can be said to make for freedom. Does freedom mean the right to do and be, to be and do exactly as everybody else? How much does this kind of uniformity depend on obeying the orders of commercial suggestion? It takes money to conform in this way. Does conformity become an ideal to strive for? So he's looking at this and saying, you know, it professes to be freedom American style, but really it's conformity American style. And it's expensive to have all of these accoutrements, instruments of conformity, of what's perceived as the good life. So the recognition that just as Kipling was giving romantic form and in a way promoting the British Empire and trying to build up public support for the British Empire, so advertising is a way of building empire, building commercial empire. Here's an image that I thought might suggest another kind of empire. This is from a picture book about Native people in Quebec. But I thought this is a dramatic image. It's a picture of a baby boom of a kind of empire organized around religion, the Roman Catholic religion. Part of the frustration, I think, in the Islam world is that there isn't a central, there's nothing equivalent to the Vatican in the Islamic world.
Why does that create frustration?
Because if you're in of a certain view, you want a state structure.
Because what I've heard about the reason that Islam has spread so wide and so and been so embraced in so many different cultures is because it has a lot of flexibility. It's exactly that lack of rigidity.
Yeah. Of course, it had in the Ottoman Empire, it once had a central state mechanism. It had an agency of state power. And, one view of a particular view of Islam is that the effort is to find a way to recreate some kind of center, some kind of a center of authority, state center of authority for Islam. I'm just, as we talk about decolonization, I'm looking at the other side and saying, you know, there's different ways we can think about empire. Certainly we've talked a lot about the American empire, and this is a very famous article by Michael Ignatieff, who just got elected to Parliament. Michael Ignatieff, I would say, has been a propagandist for the American Empire, has been an apologist for the American Empire. He has credentials as a kind of left-wing figure who has some writes about human rights. So his basic approach is in this New York Times article, which was published in January of 2003, was we might as well get used to the reality that the American Empire exists, and he would like to actually see the American Empire become more elaborate, more developed, more subject to a rule of law.
Canadian or American?
He's a very famous Canadian. He is going to run for head of the Liberal Party. He's a high-profile media figure in the BBC. He's a North Atlantic figure. It's going to be interesting if he becomes a credible candidate for head of the Liberal Party. How is he going to explain this point of view, this interpretation? He was in favor of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, where the Canadian government wasn't. So he would lead the Liberal Party more towards its continentalist roots. His father was a famous diplomat, very handsome fellow. I wanted to, when we were doing this first episode with Tony Seed and Alexa McDonough was there. This was a text that I wanted to draw attention to. Yeah.
There's a comment in the chat room. Geez, Tony, tell the whole story. Ignatieff is a prominent human rights lecturer at Harvard and has been for 15 years.
Who's it coming from?
Luddite.
Who?
Luddite? I never know how to say that word.
A Luddite?
That's what he calls himself.
Yeah. Can you ask Luddite who he is or where he is? Or Luddite, of course, is the people against, modern technology. Michael Ignatieff, he's a Harvard professor. I saw him prominently featured in the bombing of Yugoslavia, NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia. He was promoting that war in the days when Conrad Black used his control of the of that those newspapers. Working within that organization. Can I go to the board here?
I'll make that one.
Yeah.
He says he should know it's Ron.
What's that?
He says he should know it's Ron.
I should know, or who should know?
Yeah, you should know who it is.
Yeah.
But he also writes it's Ron.
It's wrong. I don't know what's wrong, but anyway, there's a Conrad Black.
Ron. The name Ron, R-O-N.
Ron Howe. Okay, Ron Howe, yes. Yeah, Ron Howe. Hi, Ron. Okay, so Ignatieff is a big name. His father was I think they're white Russians. His father was a major diplomat. I've seen Ignatieff on BBC shows. Ignatieff had a very high profile job as a professor at Harvard. And he has left-wing credentials. And so we expect to see right-wing think tank figures doing propaganda for the Bush regime, for the invasion of Iraq. But you're more surprised when you see left-wing figures, figures who have a profile as human rights experts, for instance. So his basic approach, like Neil Ferguson, for instance, Neil Ferguson, who wrote this text, which I've been using pictures from, Neil Ferguson, who did a BBC series, and this is the text based on that BBC series, Ignatieff and Neil Ferguson both take the view that the United States should formalize its imperial role, should structure the American empire with a system of law, and we should frankly understand that the United States represents the major force for good and evil, for good or evil on the planet, so we might as well face up to that reality and encourage the United States to formalize its involvement in large parts of the world, especially the Middle East, to put in place the formal structures of empire. So that is the arguments that Ignatieff will be bringing to the race to see who will become the next leader of the ruling party in Canada. Am I doing okay, Ron? Is this a fuller representation?
He said was chuckle.
Chuckle. Okay. here's another view of. This is, of course, Conrad Black, who's seen dark times recently, but here he's going to a costume ball and dressing himself as if he's some kind of archbishop in the church. Big part. That's Barbara Emil, who is a columnist in his newspapers, and is his wife. And so this is when they're riding high, before they were accused of a kleptocracy. Here's another view of empire, Gore Vidal. How many of you know Gore Vidal? Have you heard of Gore Vidal? He's a very powerful, almost iconographic figure in U.S. culture. He's written many novels and history books. This is an article I wrote in the Globe and Mail, a book review of Louis Lapham's book, Gag Rule, on the suppression of dissent and the stifling of democracy, and Gore Vidal's text, Imperial America. So both these critics of the American empire, they're both patricians, they're both very elite, rich Americans from elite, rich families. Gore Vidal is, he's gay and he's assertively gay. Anyway, they've left their class position to take a very penetrating and critical look at the United States. I was going to draw attention to this concept of Canada as the central point of nexus in the North Atlantic Triangle. And this text is first published in 1945. So this North Atlantic Triangle draws attention to the fact that Canada has an interesting relationship to the history and culture of imperialism. Canada has played the role of interpreter of Europe and interpreter of Great Britain to the United States, and vice versa, interpreter of the United States to Europe and Great Britain. Canada is situated at the nexus point between these two powers, Great Britain being the former superpower, the most powerful country on earth, the United States being the present superpower. So the Canada has an interesting role in the meeting place, both geographically and temporally, you know, in terms of time between these two imperial systems. Here's a view from Benjamin Barber that what we're seeing nowadays is an empire built largely on fear, the exploitation of fear, and he's quite critical that although you may be able to exercise power by making people afraid of some enemy, in fact, you can't liberate people's full creative capacities with that kind of kind of strategy. Here is another critique of the U.S. empire. The author of this is Mike Schur, and Mike Schur was assigned to watch Osama bin Laden in the years and months leading up to 9/11, and he basically criticizes the United States for its imperial hubris, for its arrogance, for its embrace of power to the extent that it will neglect now the truth. Here's another play on the concept of empire, an empire of wealth, the epic history of American economic power. So this here's some other images. I think I've used this image before, but these are this is an account, a pictorial account of the largest economies on Earth. So the United States, as it was in 2001, was by far the largest global economy, then Germany, then the United Kingdom, then Italy, then Japan, then France, then ExxonMobil, then Walmart,
yes,
then General Motors, then Ford Motors, then the Netherlands, then Brazil, then Daimler Chrysler, then Royal Dutch Shell, then BP, then General Electric, then Mitsubishi, then Canada, then Toyota, then Mitsui, then Belgium, then Spain, then Citigroup. So you get the idea that these corporate conglomerates now represent concentrations of wealth and power, and with that comes political influence. And except for a handful of large North American and European countries, these biggest of the corporate conglomerates are now bigger economies than most countries. Oprah? I don't see Oprah yet, but let's just keep going. Citigroup, Sweden, Nippon, Enron, AXA, Australia, IBM, Volkswagen. So obviously this is a different view of empire. It suggests a different view of empire. Here's another view of that's a good point. Yeah. It's a flawed list. It must be up there. Although, you know, you always hear about Microsoft in relationship to the wealth of Bill Gates. But it's possible that Bill Gates just owns a huge part of Microsoft, and Microsoft, it's a good point for study, for some investigation. So, so I want to, you know, now connect this, okay, let's also, one more image of empire building. Or one more group of images. So this is the final few images from the Confederation Life Insurance collection of paintings to celebrate the empire building of Canada, or the growth of Canada. The first St. Lawrence Canal, Captain William Twiss, builder of the first lock in North America, inspects the new project at Coteau du Lac, 1781. The United Empire Loyalists arrive. The Toronto Purchase. Captain George Vancouver. First Parliament of Upper Canada. First Parliament of Lower Canada. I mean, this is striking in that it's all white people. It's all people of European ancestry, and that's the way nation building is seen. But here's an image, one of my often referred to images. This is the Aboriginal government as it was in 1910 at the Six Nations community near Brantford. Confederacy Chiefs and Council House about 1910. Note flags. Is there something coming up on the chat that?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry. You brought up something how it's something you brought up to Nadia.
Yeah.
How do you bring up a whole new viewpoint to people who hold a whole new viewpoint to what you might think, especially in class? And what I agree with you is that he even had an excellent lecture last year, and I asked, wow. Someone who fought during the last two wars or over? No, not exactly. He's a U.S. reservist who actually led a really real year at the last year. Thank you all about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was when George Bush was in Ottawa, and it's quite interesting. And then he proceeded to talk about training CIA officers. Anyway, here's an image. I think this image is significant in that it shows a kind of marriage of Indigenous peoples and Aboriginal culture. So this government prevailed until they sent their ambassador to Geneva in the early 1920s, seeking some sort of international recognition and blowing the whistle on Canada, claiming that Canada was not ascribing to this tradition of crown treaty making and treaty alliance, treating the people as allies of the crown. But here you see a marriage of the British Empire with an Aboriginal culture. Yeah.
Tony, this is a government of who or what?
This is the government of the League of the Haudenosaunee. This is the government that Lewis Henry Morgan wrote about in 1850 in the League of the Haudenosaunee. This is the as it existed in 1910. This is the government that Karl Marx and Frederick Engels got quite interested in through their reading of Lewis Henry Morgan.